The government shutdown has left thousands of federal employees either unpaid or on furlough. A second missed paycheck tomorrow could put families in a financial crisis. It's bringing to light just how many people, employed by the government or not, live paycheck to paycheck. We're looking at middle-class financial realities here on The Morning Show. I'm Kedar Chir-Kent. In 2017, the job site Career Builder did a survey and found 78% of U.S. workers are living paycheck to paycheck. Are you? We're at 800-642-1234. What are some of the expenses that keep you from getting ahead? Is it the monthly mortgage or rent? Is it childcare, perhaps caring for a sick parent? And that can be expensive. Join in at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Sarah Halpern-Meekin is an associate professor of human development and family studies at UW's School of Human Ecology. She co-authored the book, It's Not Like I'm Poor, How Working Families Make Ends Meet in a Post-Welfare World. Sarah, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
Taking a look at that 78% of Americans living paycheck to paycheck, what is putting so many people in that situation?
I think, as you said in the introduction, there are so many expenses that families face today, and so many of those can feel non-negotiable. You have to have your kids in daycare so that you can work. If you have a sick relative, you have to take care of family. You have to have a place to live, and you have to, you know, put gas in the car to get from here to there. So there are a lot of expenses families face. And I think on the other side of things, work can often offer a lot of instability. We're seeing that with the furloughed federal workers now, but for a lot of families, that happens on a regular basis. They might not get the hours they were expecting, they might lose a shift, and then all of a sudden your paycheck's a little less than you were expecting, and it makes it that much harder to cover the bills.
What about being asset poor, and what is asset poor?
So asset poor, asset poverty, is really different than income poverty, and it's not talked about nearly as much. It means that you don't have enough resources to cover 3 months of most basic expenses without that paycheck coming in. And for a large proportion of American families, that's the reality. It's nearly half of American families, according to a Federal Reserve study from last year, can't cover even $400 without having to sell something or, otherwise borrow money in order to cover an expense as small as $400. So a lot of families are really unable to go beyond just spending what they expect to spend every month and have that paycheck try to stretch to cover those costs.
And when you think of selling off an asset, what might that asset be? Perhaps it's a car, but a lot of people are very far away from even owning a home.
Yeah, so it's usually not something, if you're trying to cover a $400 expense, we're often not talking about selling a car or a home, but, maybe something smaller, maybe that, special ring that your grandmother gave you or something like that. Choosing not to make a purchase that you might otherwise have made, maybe avoiding buying that new pair of shoes and letting your toe hang through the shoe for a week or two before the next paycheck comes in.
And when you say income poor, what do you mean by income poor?
So there's an official federal definition of poverty that has to do with how much your earned income is every year. And if it falls below the official federal poverty line, which for an individual is around $12,000, for a family of four, we're talking around $25,000. If your income for the year falls below that level, that classifies you as income poor. And there are many people who are not income poor, whose incomes are far above that federal poverty line, who are nevertheless asset poor, who aren't able to have enough in savings that they can carry themselves without relying on a paycheck for that immediate month.
Help us put a face on this. Who are these Americans who are scraping by, and what are the jobs they're working that are putting them in a situation where they can't live paycheck to paycheck?
They're really all of us. So there's not a them. It's us. so many people are working jobs where they can cover their bills for now, but without that paycheck, they are up the creek without the paddle. People are teachers, people are working hourly wage jobs. People are, as we're seeing among the federal workers, working jobs that they thought were going to be really secure government jobs and were willing to even take a pay cut in order to have the security of a government job that is just not there.
We're talking with Sarah Halpern-Meekin. She's an associate professor of human development and family studies at UW's School of Human Ecology. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think is the solution here? What would you need to get ahead? An income boost, more affordable child care, fewer health care costs? What do you think are some policy changes that could put a dent in the issue? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Sarah, let's take a look at childcare for a moment. How much of a burden does this put on parents? And have you seen any policy making on the horizon that could impact the costs of childcare?
The costs of childcare for anyone with a young child is often astronomical. In a lot of states, the cost of high-quality childcare exceeds the cost of a public in-state college tuition. And when we're looking at that, you hear all the time about student loans and student debt and there being a crisis there, and there certainly is. But that really ignores what's happening in the early years of the lifespan for children, which is they need to be in high-quality childcare for their own development, and their parents need them someplace safe so that they can go to work and not be distracted by worries over how their child's doing. And so those costs of childcare, you often get what you pay for. Really inexpensive childcare might leave you feeling worried, might not be the best environment for your child. And so those costs for families are just enormous.
I recall there was an interview we had here on the Ideas Network with an author from San Francisco who wrote about childcare and said that in San Francisco, they wouldn't even put a price tag. You couldn't see prices before you went to tour, and they would give you a pricing after the tour, but they wouldn't even put prices on their website or anything like that. And it struck me as pretty alarming there, that not being even forthright with how much this could actually cost.
Yeah, I mean, San Francisco is truly exceptional in its costs. I think most of us would run screaming from any of the costs they would list for housing or childcare or anything like that. But even here in Wisconsin, the costs of childcare are not inexpensive, and it's a large burden on families to try to cover or to make the decision that a parent is not going to go to work and give up those earnings, because it just doesn't pay to have most of your paycheck going to pay for childcare.
Have we seen that, though? Have we seen a parent holding back more? Is there a trend toward that or not? Or both parents in the workforce and just doing what they can?
There's certainly not a large trend toward that. A lot of families don't feel like they can afford to do that. And for, it would oftentimes be a woman, a mom who would be withdrawing from the labor force. And that can be devastating to her career and her future earnings as well. So there's the short versus long term there families have to consider.
Talking with Sarah Halpern-Meekin. She is our guide. She's an associate professor of human development and family studies at UW-Madison. Talking about the realities of living paycheck to paycheck, what the research is telling us as well. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What keeps you from getting ahead? What would you need to change that? What is the impact to you during this partial government shutdown? Join the conversation. We'll get back to it in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're talking about living paycheck to paycheck here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Brookings Institution is looking at the financial hit this shutdown is having on the middle class, and they're writing about how financial institutions are surprisingly ill-equipped with reasonable products to help families handle short-term, small-dollar credit needs. And families who overspend on their debit card are hit with a $35 overdraft fee, and this adds up. Americans overdraft to the tune of $24 billion a year. Did you overdraft recently? Did you see it coming, or was it caused by an unexpected expense like a car repair or a doctor bill? We're at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Sarah Halpern-Meekin stays with us. She is an associate professor of human development and family studies at UW-Madison. We've been talking about childcare, but there's also the expense associated with caring for an adult or an aging parent. How can caring for a parent or another adult weigh a person's finances down?
More and more people are in that position, right, are in this sandwich generation of even covering those childcare costs at the same time that they're caring for an older relative. And that can mean trade-offs again, right? Either paying for care so that you can go to work or stepping back from work to some extent so that you can do the care yourself. And so it's a lot of, you know, any care work involves a lot of the same trade-offs. Do you pay to get some assistance, or are you going to give up pay so that you can do that care work yourself? And a lot of families feel stuck in that decision.
What is the emotional toll of living life knowing that if an emergency strikes, you wouldn't have the funds to recover from it? How can that affect people?
So I think there's first the stress, right? The worry, the wonder, feeling like, you know, there's no plan B, that if plan A doesn't work out, things are not going to go well. That can be really stressful for people. And then if things don't go well, right, if, you know, that paycheck doesn't come through, if you lose a few hours, you're immediately in a position where you're just trying to keep your head above water. That can be really stressful on parents. That can make it a lot harder for them to be engaging with their kids in the ways that they'd like to. And it naturally leads to worries about what kind of parent am I being? Am I able to really fulfill the obligations I have to my kids, to my older parents, the way that I want to? So many families are worried about whether their kids will do as well as they did. And we're seeing more and more that's not the case. Fewer and fewer children do as well financially as their parents did before them. And so families face very real concerns about what sort of life they can give to their children when they get to be grown-ups.
In the shutdown, it is exposing just how fragile financial situations are among families. And there's this hashtag shutdown stories. It started trending after U.S. Representative Scott Perry said, quote, "Who's living that they're not going to make it to the next paycheck?" So there seems to be an assumption, perhaps a disconnect, that people should have that nest egg saved up in case of an emergency. But how much is this about personal responsibility versus circumstances that are out of control of that person?
So people certainly can make, different sets of decisions about their purchases and their finance, and can try to make choices about saving. But I think what's really important to keep in mind is the context in which people make those choices, right? So as we were talking about before, if you decide you're going to pay a lot less for childcare and then put that money away in savings, what is the cost to your child, to your family, to your sanity as you worry about whether your kid has just been parked in front of a TV for 8 hours, right? So families face very real choices that are not just, should I go on a Caribbean vacation or should I save? They're facing really hard trade-offs. And the other thing to keep in mind is, in order to save, you have to have some predictability. And for a lot of families, there isn't predictability in their earnings. In that Federal Reserve report I mentioned earlier, nearly a third of families said that they faced large income fluctuations from month to month. How do you do savings and financial planning when you don't know what your income is going to be? And also, we've seen in our research that a large proportion of working families face income shocks. You know, that car repair you didn't expect to have to make, the furnace breaking that you didn't expect to have to cover. And so saving for the rainy day that you don't know is going to happen, you can do that, but that rainy day comes often when the car breaks and when the furnace needs to be fixed, and then that savings is gone. So it's not as simple as, you know, socking it away in a Roth IRA and just sitting back and letting the money roll in.
So Wisconsin's minimum wage is $7.25 an hour, but there have been movements to bump that up across the country. Could raising the minimum wage be a solution here for Americans living paycheck to paycheck, or is it bigger than that?
I think it's really bigger than that. As we were talking about, this is not an issue that just applies to the lowest income family. You know, if somebody is working full-time, full year at minimum wage, they're bringing in about $15,000 a year. We're talking about families who are earning double, triple, quadruple that, who are really facing these tough issues about living paycheck to paycheck. And so raising the minimum wage can be an important policy discussion, but I think it doesn't go terribly far in addressing the real financial needs that a lot of families who are earning well above minimum wage face.
Let's take a moment to look at the earned income tax credit. The government shutdown could delay that tax refund. In the past, you vouched for a policy that was introduced in the Senate in 2016 that would have allowed tax filers to save a portion of their refund for an emergency later in the year. It didn't make it out of committee, but are policies like this part of a solution for low-income Americans?
We were hoping that there would be some thought about how we can build ways to make saving easier for people. Not just low-income Americans, but a lot of Americans get a refund check at tax time because we've overpaid or because we are eligible for, you know, the earned income tax credit or the child tax credit. And that means that we have a little bit of financial leeway at tax time in a way that we often don't for most of the rest of the year. And so the idea is to make it a little easier for people to engage in savings where they don't have to get that money and then disperse it themselves, but they can check a box when they're filing their taxes and say, hold on to that for me for later.
Looking back 50 years or so, how have changes to the structure of our American family impacted the way we make and spend money?
That's such an important question because our families look really different now than they did 50 years ago. We have a lot more single parent families. We have a lot more children living with grandparents who may be retired. And we have a lot more two income families where both parents are working. And what that means is that there is just a lot less to fall back on. So if a single parent loses his or her job, there's not another person who can pick up the slack in the household. In a two-income family, it's the same thing. If one person loses their job, the family's down half their income. It used to be the case oftentimes that in a two-parent family, only one of those parents was working. And if that parent lost a job, the second parent might be able to go get a job to help tide them over for the time being. So there's not somebody who can really just step up to the plate in a tough time because it's already all hands on deck.
Let's go to Greeley now, joining us from Madison. Hi, Greeley.
Good morning.
Good morning. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I'm a retired UW-trained physician and psychiatrist, and my question is quite simple. When will we have a culture that allows women to choose either not to have a child or to have one-child families?
Due to the expense of the cost of a child and bringing up a child?
Exactly.
Okay.
And you haven't mentioned what that cost is.
Greeley, we're short on time, and I want you to be able to respond to that, Sarah.
Yeah, so I think more and more people are making that choice. We've seen that the number of children that women have has been shrinking over time. Whether that's a cause for concern or a cause for celebration is an open question. But more women are choosing to have fewer children or no children. So we are seeing things go in that direction.
Yeah, New York Times reported that the amount of money parents spent on children is highest, not when they're under six, but when they're over 18 and into their mid-20s. Why is that?
I think there are really large expenses people face when they're going to college, when they're setting up their young adult lives. And oftentimes nowadays, parents are continuing to help children out with those costs.
And as we wrap up really quick here, what could be a step in the right direction?
I think in the short term, there are policies that could be put in place to address the current pressing needs of workers who are going without a paycheck, possibly that second paycheck tomorrow. But those are really just addressing the needs of one small group of people. We need to have a larger conversation about how to put more families in a position where covering costs is reasonable and where incomes are dependable.
Sarah, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Sarah Halpern-Meekin is an associate professor of human development and family studies at University of Wisconsin School of Human Ecology, UW-Madison. She co-authored the book, It's Not Like I'm Poor, How Working Families Make Ends Meet in a Post-Welfare World. Coming up next, we consider the shutdown's potential effects on Wisconsin's food share program and on food banks. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're with us on The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As the shutdown drags on in unprecedented 5 weeks, federal workers may turn to food banks and other programs to help cover basic living needs. And this is happening straight across the country. Houston's food bank is the largest in the country, and it's seen an increase in demand at its on-site pantry where people can make appointments to eat. We're checking in on food supplies here in Wisconsin. Do you rely on Wisconsin's food share program? Have you gotten a letter saying that your March allocation of food benefits is $0? Have you been making plans about what to do with your February allocation if there isn't any money in March? We're at 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. David Lee is executive director of Feeding Wisconsin. That's a statewide association of the Feeding America food banks, providing more than 750 agencies and 1,000 local food programs throughout the state. David, welcome to the Ideas Network.
So good to be with you this morning.
Well, let's start with the shutdown on day 34 here, which is really about federal workers missing paychecks and not being able to make ends meet and being able to meet those basic living necessities, which include food. What options are there if families are in these circumstances right now?
Sure. So for the folks who are being affected by the shutdown, who need food, I would say that our network has been around for the last, 40 or so years, ensuring that people who are in these temporary straits have the nutritious food they need to be able to work, learn, and live healthy lives. And if anybody is out there who is being affected by the shutdown, they ought to call 211 to get connected to a local food pantry or some other services that they might be eligible for.
How do food banks here in Wisconsin prepare to make sure they're ready to deal with the crisis, whether it's people not getting paid during a shutdown or a natural disaster?
Sure. So our food banks do this work every day. They reach out to donors. They're ensuring that they have enough food supplies, fund supplies, volunteers to have the food ready for our food pantries to be able to order and get and stock their shelves so that people in local communities can get the food that they need. So I would say that this this temporary shutdown, hopefully, is no different than a flood that some of the floods that we saw in southern western Wisconsin last summer or earlier this fall, or an earthquake or some other natural disaster, right? And I think what's this larger picture that you were talking about with Dr. Halpern-Meekin earlier is that we are also serving over 550,000 people every day already, right? So this temporary increase let me walk that back a little bit and say that, anybody who is dealing with food insecurity is dealing with a crisis in their homes every day, right? But this, temporary increase is we can rise to meet this need. I think the thing that we're a little bit concerned about is what happens when the food share benefit, what happens to the food share benefit in March? That becomes sort of a different question for us.
So the food share benefits, which are currently in flux during the shutdown. That is Wisconsin's food stamp program, which may feel the effects of prolonged shutdown. In January, the USDA announced it would pay February food share benefits. How does this work?
Yeah, so this is actually very interesting. I'm glad you brought that up. So in Wisconsin, the food share benefit is dispersed over the first 15 days of the month, depending on the last digit of your Social Security number. USDA in January announced that February benefits would be dispersed on January 20th, on or around January 20th. So people in the listening area who are on food share ought to check their EBT cards to make sure that they've gotten their February benefits loaded. Now, there's this really interesting sort of side effect of this, right? I mean, it is very possible that somebody who got their January benefit on January 15th got their February benefit on or around January 20th, which means that they're going to have to budget and stretch those food share dollars over the course of over a month to get to March 15th, hopefully when the shutdown is over, to have benefits, their March benefits on their food share card. Now, of course, as you mentioned as well, the guidance that USDA and the states have been given is that potentially there may not be March benefits due to this extended government shutdown.
If that's the case and there are not March benefits, what do you see happening for these families?
I think if there are no March benefits, we're going to have a lot bigger fish to fry, right? Just to give you a sense of scale, our network of food banks last year provided somewhere on the order of $90 million worth of food. That's a lot of food to a lot of people. And the work of our local volunteers and our staff is incredible, right? The food share benefit provides about $75 million worth in grocery and buying benefits to our state of Wisconsin every month. So, while we can absorb the temporary increase somewhere on the order of, you know, tens of thousands of people coming into our system to get the food they need, if the food share benefit is not funded in March, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of people, right? And that's not really a thing we can prepare for.
We're hearing reports of pop-up food banks in Washington, D.C. We're hearing about federal agencies contacting the Houston Food Bank, asking to get distribution trucks to go to furloughed workers. Are food banks expected to be more accessible during the shutdown and meet workers where they are? Are you seeing anything like this happening in Wisconsin?
Not yet, but I suspect if the shutdown continues and our network gets asked, our food banks will definitely do everything in their power to meet the needs in local communities. I think in some of these areas that you mentioned, you know, Maryland, Houston, there's a high proportion. There's a lot of federal workers in our state. It's somewhere on the order of 20,000-25,000 people, largely concentrated in two or three counties. So, you know, we're seeing our current system as it's currently working. We believe we'll be able to absorb that temporary increase. Now, again, if this continues on for a while, and if these federal agencies reach out to our food banks, our food banks will do whatever they can to be able to meet the need. And this is something, again, they've been doing for the last 40 years in the context of all manner of temporary disruptions, local factory closures, disasters, floods, you name it.
Talking with David Lee, he's Executive Director of Feeding Wisconsin. You can join in with your circumstances, your thoughts on this situation as people need food. Do you rely on Wisconsin's food share program? Have you gotten a letter saying that your March allocation of food benefits is $0? Have you been making plans about what to do with your February allocation if there isn't money in March? Let us know what's on your mind at 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. David Lee, can people still submit food share applications during a shutdown? How does the processing work?
Yeah, so currently our state is still accepting food share applications. The program is operating as normal for now. It's just an open question as to whether or not March benefits will be paid. And we're doing everything we can to make sure that happens, right? We believe that USDA has wide latitude in making sure that the benefit is dispersed. But of course, you know, without a budget and without appropriations, that question continues to be open, unfortunately. And I think if I may just really quickly just note that in the history of the food stamps program, since its inception in the 1960s, there has never been a disruption of benefits, not in times of war, not in times of recession. And this is a man-made thing that's happening. And it requires is for folks to come together, to work together across the aisle to end this.
Beyond the shutdown, what does food insecurity look like in Wisconsin?
Sure. So in our state, we have somewhere on the order of 600,000 people who are food insecure. And that's a technical term that we otherwise know as hunger, right? People who may not know where their next meal is coming from. 600,000 people is a lot, but we are at the lowest point of pure numbers of people who are food insecure in our state since about 2009. So the trends are going in the right direction. The work that we've been doing, the economy getting better, all these things are going in the right direction. And it's really unfortunate that the shutdown has really put a lot of the positive trends that we've been working on into jeopardy. And I think that's really the sad truth here, right, is that we've been slowly turning the ship around, and suddenly we have this incredible disruption that, you know, not only affects the federal workers who are furloughed, but if you think about the cascading effects of what happens if the food share benefit is not funded in March, I mean, in all of grocery, right, food share redemptions that amount to about 10% of all grocery redemptions, all grocery sales, that's a lot of money that's not going into the local economies. It's not making sure that food manufacturers are manufacturing food's not being bought, truckers aren't being utilized to move food. I mean, this is not just a couple people not getting their monthly food benefit.
When you look at the trends on food insecurity, do people fall in and out of food insecurity, or once they have the food they need and they are able to sustain themselves, that they never fall back, if you will?
Yeah, that's a great question. So food insecurity, as you know, is a temporary condition, right? I mean, people fall in and out. Typically, typically food insecure family is food insecure about three quarters of the year, you know, and it happens depending on how many hours they might work that month, or how much they might be making, or whether or not they lose a job for a couple weeks before they get another one. So it's a temporary thing, but it's definitely connected to how much money they're able to make and how many hours they're working on any given month.
Talking about food agencies, food insecurity with David Lee. He heads up Feeding Wisconsin. We're gathering your perspectives and your stories on food insecurity at 800-642-1234. Do you consider yourself to be food insecure? What does that look like for you? And what would need to happen to get to food security? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick up the discussion in a moment on the Ideas Network. We're talking about food bank reserves and how food distribution programs are managing during this government shutdown as federal workers are about to miss another paycheck tomorrow. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Feeding America has a search tool to find local food banks at feedingamerica.org. Do you rely on Wisconsin's food share program? What concerns you as you look at federal workers and being furloughed? Are you making contingency plans? Do you consider yourself to be food insecure? And what do you need to move into food security? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. David Lee stays with us. He's executive director of Feeding Wisconsin. David, how are inventories doing at food banks around the state as you look, and what are your chains doing in terms of the warehouses and the retailers, and do you feel like your supply chain is doing okay there?
Yeah, so right now our supply chain is fine. You know, like I said earlier, this is work that we've always been doing, and we are always going out to get more food to ensure that people in living throughout our state who are food insecure have the access to the nutritious food they need to be able to work, learn, and live healthy lives. I think, again, if we are going to be talking about what our supply chains are going to look like if the food share benefit isn't funded in March, that's a completely different question, right? And I think the challenges that our supply chains are going to face are physical, right? I mean, it's not the fact that there's not enough food out there. There's plenty of food in our state and across the nation to be able to go out and get. But when you think about the physical limitations of our network, you begin to see the challenges that we're facing, right? If you think about a typical food bank, it has a couple hundred pallet spaces that it uses to store and stage food. Each one of those pallets holds about 1,000 pounds of food. So on any given food bank, there's probably space to store a couple hundred thousand pounds of food. All of that food has to be touched, sorted, staged, put away, picked, and then distributed. And so when you talk about, so our supply chain works great in serving the amount of folks that are currently in our system. But when you double the amount of people who are in need or who are coming back three or four times because they don't have their food share benefit, I mean, it's going to be a real challenge for us to be able to actually move and store and distribute the food.
What kind of support do food banks need from the community?
Yeah, you know, our food banks survive on the generosity of our great donors and the generosity of our volunteers. We wouldn't be able to operate without them. And thanks to their generosity, we're able to rise to meet this need right now as the need currently stands. However, folks are interested to get involved. Reach out to your local food pantry because, you know, they might not need you now, but they might need you at some point, right, to volunteer, to give your time or funds. People can find out if they can organize a food or fund drive at our local food banks. Our food banks, actually, part of what they're doing to prepare, they're putting out extra volunteer shifts so that people can sort more food, so that we have more reserves. I mean, we're doing things to ramp up. And we need people, the fine people in Wisconsin to reach out to their food banks and get involved. And they can find out ways to get involved. They can find out about where their local food bank is on our website at feedingwisconsin.org.
Churches also used to, and certainly still do today, have lots of suppers and also serve a need. What is the role of churches today?
Churches, our network would not operate without the fine Wisconsin men and women who are volunteering at churches, right? I think about 2/3 of our network are made up of church pantries and church meal programs. So they are in local communities. The vast majority of our food pantry network are operated out of churches and local communities across the state. So their work is incredibly vital. And we wouldn't be able to serve the need without them.
So looking at this food insecurity, perhaps a more existential question I was thinking about in preparing for this conversation, will we get to a day where we'll put you out of business, where we will not need food banks? Will we get to a day of ending hunger in the U.S.?
I would love that. So that's actually funny, right? That's the question that keeps me up at night every night. So our vision is a healthy and hunger-free Wisconsin, and we believe that we will be able to achieve that vision within my lifetime. But I don't think that means that food banks and food pantries are going to go out of business. I think what that means is that everybody in our state, everybody in the nation, will be able to have easy access to the food or benefits they need to be able to live a healthy life, right? I mean, I think when you think about what food insecurity looks like in our state and in our nation, it's really that people don't have enough money to be able to meet all of their basic needs, right? And there will always be people who might not have enough money. And I'm talking about folks who just can't work, right? And I think that's historically the population we've served, right? We've served people who are elderly and people who are disabled, folks that we don't expect to work and who also don't have enough social benefits to be able to obtain all of the basic needs that they need to sustain a healthy life. I think we can, I think a more useful thought, right, is not whether or not food banks, food pantries are going to go out of business completely, but what is the right size for our network in local communities, and what is the right scope of work, right? We have, since the Great Recession, have begun to serve a lot more folks who are working but who are not making enough money or not working enough hours. And that, you know, I might say shouldn't be in our bailiwick, right? That shouldn't be the core of who we're serving. And so I think when we think about those existential questions, I think it's really incumbent upon us to really begin to envision what kind of society that we want.
We're seeing people who are applying for food benefits who have never done this before and during this shutdown, and who feel a sense of guilt, a sense of shame.
Yeah.
Talk us through that.
So the stigma of people who either are applying for food share or coming to our services is very real. We did a consumer insights project over the late summer and early fall. And we spoke to about 100 people in communities across the state, clients, and the stigma that they feel is very, very real. And I think my mouth sort of hit the ground when Dr. Halpern Meekin earlier said that, you know, the people who are the working poor, right, they're really all of us. And I think that's the one thing that I really want people to really hear and internalize, right? That, like, the people who are food insecure, the folks who are applying for food share, the folks who are coming into our system, they are all of us. They are us, right? They are our friends and neighbors. And we really ought to be taking care of them without judgment and ensuring that they have just the very basic needs so that they can get on about the work of making sure that their families have enough to eat.
In the last minute we have with you, what are you watching moving forward when it comes to those in need because of the partial government shutdown and as winter continues here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, we are watching for whether or not this shutdown ends. There are going to be two votes today in D.C. that will hopefully set up a path forward for the shutdown ending that'll deal with the sort of immediate need that we are seeing, and hopefully that'll deal with the food share question in March. I think we're making sure that all of our food banks and food pantries have enough food to make sure that God, it's going to get cold, right? So we want to make sure that folks who are really either out of doors or otherwise need food have the resources so that they can make it through this first cold snap. And we hope that this government shutdown ends sooner rather than later, so we can continue to keep those trends going in the right direction for food insecurity.
David, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
David Lee is Executive Director of Feeding Wisconsin. He joined us to consider what effects the shutdown is having on hunger relief organizations. Earlier, we talked about the stress on families living paycheck to paycheck. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.